Hello, and welcome to a brand new Chris Williams podcast. It's been a while. Apologize for that, but we, you know, I got other stuff to do too. Fire these up as soon as we get the interesting people to put on there, and that's exactly what I have for you today. I had so much fun with this interview with Dean David Spalding from the Iowa State College of Business, a longtime Wall Street guy. If you guys know me, you listen to my shows, you know I'm obsessed with like investing, and it's really become a hobby of mine over the years, and really wanted to pick his brain on what Wall Street used to be like, what Wall Street is like today, how regular people like you and me can build wealth, and the, you know, the benefits of technology with that, and how it all plays into business in 2021 in higher education. He is a fascinating guy, and I know that you all will get a lot out of this. Before we get to the interview, speaking of a quality business, I can't thank my friends at MechDyne and the MechDyne Corporation enough. They have been a great partner of ours, not only at Cyclone Fanatic, but here on 712 Media as well. And I'm always encouraging people to look ahead, challenge yourself. They've got a job board at MechDyne.com. That's MechDyne.com. And I'm always encouraging people to take a look over there. I know the CEO, Chris, very well, very good friend of mine, one of the most stand-up quality human beings you will ever meet. I always kind of joke around, but I'm also being kind of serious that if I ever get kicked out of this media deal, I'm absolutely going to probably call MechDyne. I'm looking at it right now. There are open jobs all over the country. Everywhere from New York to Marshalltown, Iowa to Des Moines. They got them everywhere. And check it out. Go to MechDyne.com. Just an amazing Iowa company that has made its way worldwide. They are the exclusive sponsor of the Chris Williams podcast. And I know that they'll appreciate this interview today that I do with Dean Spalding. How this all came together. So you guys know Brent Bloom. Lives right down the street from me. He's my podcast partner on Cyclone Fanatic. And, I mean, Brent's been my best friend for, 15 years. We do everything together. Our families do everything together. Our kids are best friends. Our wives are best friends. And Brent knows Dean Spalding well, works for and raises money for the college business. I don't know exactly what Brent does, but it's something to do with fundraising. And he was telling me months ago, he's like, you know, I think you two would really hit it off because we have so many things in common. Obviously, Dean Spalding is much smarter than I am, as we will see here during this podcast. But that's how this all came together. Bloom thought that he would be a great, you know, source for us here as we continue to try and grow together and learn together and have some fun as well. So with that, really hope you guys enjoy this. I'd appreciate you if you would rate, subscribe, review, and share the Chris Williams podcast from 712 Media. This will continue to grow. I know that it's been spotty on when I do it, but I would love feedback. It seems like you guys really enjoy these interviews. Who would you like to hear from? That type of stuff. And hopefully in the year 2022, we can get more consistent. This pandemic, man, like it's still disrupting our lives, like with kids and stuff like that. So it's just, you know, anytime anybody has a stuffy nose, oh my God, do I have the Delta variant? Like I'm hopeful that things will continue to kind of simmer here for everybody in the coming months. But with that, here's this interview with Dean Spalding. I hope you guys really enjoy it. Thanks so much for listening. All right, Dean Spalding. Do you want to be called? What do you want to be called? Dean, David, Mr. Spalding. How do we do this?
David, please.
David, please. All right. Dartmouth.
Actually, just David, not David, please. But
of course. First of all, you went to Dartmouth. You worked at Dartmouth. What's it like on an Ivy League campus? Like, do they have TVs? Do y'all just sit around and read books all the time? What's it like?
So, you know, Shonda Rhimes, who produces and writes Grey's Anatomy, is a Dartmouth alum.
Really?
And Grey is a Dartmouth grad. And so when I was working there, all the students had to be back in their rooms by whatever night it was when Grey's Anatomy was on. They had watch parties watching Grey's Anatomy. So,
wow.
Yes, they do watch television on Ivy League campuses.
That's good. I've only, we only see it like the movies where... was it Facebook? Wasn't that created on an Ivy League
it
campus?
It was Harvard.
Yeah. And they just kind of hung around their dorms creating codes. That's kind of what I have in my mind. Yeah. I'm an Iowa State guy, so.
No, yeah. Understood. I know some of that goes on, too. I know there are plenty of fraternities and plenty of parties, too. And there's good stuff happening in the classroom, just like there's good stuff happening in the classroom here at Iowa State.
Absolutely. All right, so I want to give a little bit of your background to the listeners before we dig in, because I've got a plethora of questions for you.
All right.
On the surface, it may not look like we have a lot in common, but we actually do. I'm fascinated by your background. So you were on Wall Street in the 80s? Is that accurate?
From the mid-70s to 2005.
Oh, okay.
So almost 30 years.
So what did you do exactly during your time on Wall Street?
Yeah, so I started as a baby banker knocking on doors in the garment district, trying to do middle market lending. The Empire State Building was one of my territories. So,
oh, wow.
You know, today would be the day I'd go hit the 40th floor and knock on the door of all the different companies on the 40th floor and try to get them to do business with the bank I worked for.
Wow.
But I ultimately moved into first lending to and then leading investments in leveraged buyouts. So this was really a disruptive technology that came out, financial technology that came out in the 1980s, where private equity firms would raise money from pensions and from insurance companies, from wealthy investors, and pool that money together and buy a company by borrowing a lot of money, putting in some equity and owning the business for 5 years. And the goal was you sold it for more than you paid for it. I mean, that's always the objective.
So were you the guy who was getting on the plane, flying to Florida to negotiate a deal more so than you weren't on the like trading floor? Like with your hand in the air, like, oh, I want this. That's what most people think of Wall Street.
No, that's right. Yeah, I was definitely not that guy on the trading floor. I was the guy climb on the plane, fly down to Florida, negotiate the deal. You know, we've done a lot of work in your company. We want to make an offer to buy your company and negotiate everything involved in the deal. And then, you know, the fun part was chasing the deal, but then another piece of the fun part was being owning the company and being on the board of directors and working with the CEO and the senior team on strategy for the company and how do we make sure that their interests are the same as our interests. So we're all being driven by growth in the stock price and the value of the business. And so it was really, really fun work and a chance to look and learn about a lot of different companies, meet a lot of great people. I loved it. It was great while I was there.
Okay, so we're going to get back to all that, and I want to pick your brain about Wall Street. But how did we end up here at Iowa State? Because that seems, you know, that to me, it seems like quite a leap from the Empire State Building to being the dean of the Ivy College of Business at Iowa State.
You know, if you'd told me when I was knocking on those doors that this was where I was going to end up, I would have said you were crazy. So, yes, it is. It is quite a transition. So, what happened was my partners and I had founded our own firm on Wall Street, our own private equity firm. Did that for about 9 years through two investment funds. And at that point, I really decided that I had accomplished what I wanted to accomplish on the street. I'd had a good career there. I'd enjoyed what I was doing, but it was time to do something with a higher mission. And I've always really believed in the transformative mission of higher education, bringing in students, opening up the world to them, providing them knowledge, helping them explore things that they want to explore, and sending them out into the world on a different path than they would have been on had they not come to college. And my father was a first-generation college student. I really saw how it totally transformed his life.
Yeah.
I had friends who were first-generation when I went to Dartmouth. And so I decided to do something with a higher mission. Higher education very much fits that from my standpoint. And so when I decided to retire from the firm I co-founded, the president of Dartmouth said, why don't you come on up here and work for me? So Went back up to Dartmouth, worked for there for 8 years as a senior administrator. I had a number of aspects of the college that reported to me, including athletics. I will say Ivy League athletics, very different than Big 12 athletics.
No doubt about that.
You know, the crowds aren't the same. The money isn't the same. And yeah, as the football coach at Dartmouth said, those Big 12 guys are a lot faster than my guys are. So, but I really enjoyed
well,
that.
Well, now at least. We didn't maybe used to be, but I've been here for too long. You've been here during the good years, put it that way.
I've been here for quite a run.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But, you know, I enjoyed my time at Dartmouth, but I really wanted to get closer to the academic side. And so what Iowa State offered me was the opportunity to be dean of the College of Business here, get more actively engaged with where the magic really happens, which is in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so a chance to work with a great faculty brought us closer to family. My wife's from the Quad Cities, so just a few hours away.
Great.
We'd spent our whole time on the East Coast, and so really jumped at the opportunity to come to this really beautiful campus and work with a great group of people here.
Okay, so I'm journalism 2007. One of my great regrets, having gone through everything I have now, which is basically building a company. So I was joking with Michelle earlier. I used to be a sports writer, and then now I'm like a travel agent. I'm doing books. I'm right. Like
right.
It's, and I do think if I could make one pitch for what you all are doing here, I think anybody could use a business degree. It doesn't matter what area. My wife is a veterinarian. One of the things we learn, a lot of these veterinarians are they're brilliant with what they do. They can do surgery on all these different species, but they don't know how to run a business. It's completely foreign to them. They take one class in vet med, right? And I think that would be one. If there's any young people listening, I think anybody could get a business degree. Do you agree with that?
I think you're absolutely right. And I think, frankly, they don't have to go as far as get a business degree. You know, take three courses over here.
Yeah.
You know, take a basic accounting course, take a basic marketing course, take a management course. You're going to be much better prepared for a lot of those challenges you're going to face in life with that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get to some of this fun stuff that I've been dying to talk to you about Wall Street, because I'm a geek. So a lot of my listeners know this. It was, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. It was right before I had my first child. I got into this, and I don't know why. One of my best friend he's actually an Ivy College of Business graduate, and he's really good at all this stuff. And me and him, we did a business deal together where we purchased 10% of a new hotel that was going in our hometown. And it kind of got me into investing, and I really started to, I got the itch. I bought five shares of Apple for $90 a piece, and a year later it was doubled. And I was like, whoa, this is kind of cool, right? It was at the time, David, where even just buying five shares of Apple, you had like an $8 commission fee or whatever. When I was at Iowa State, I don't even think that a guy like me could have bought a stock. I could have, but I would have had to drive to West Des Moines, go to some office, right? Meet with a financial advisor, which I don't think kids were doing. I think it's fascinating now because you can buy, I mean, if you had $1 million in an account, you could buy 1 million shares of Apple on your cell phone at the snap of a finger. So to me, like it's become, investing has become so much more manageable for, you know, the lower to middle class. That's the biggest change I've seen. How is it different now compared to when you were doing this in the 80s on Wall Street?
Well, I think you're right. This democratization of investing is one of the major sea changes here in the United States. It's not only these disruptions of the financial markets. Now, basically, all of us have always participated in the market. You know, if you worked for a company and you had a pension, your pension was being invested in stocks. Mm-hmm. And so you didn't have control over it. You weren't making the investment decisions, but you had a piece of the market. You just didn't realize that you were invested there. I think now with the opening, with technology that's being used, with the opportunity to buy fractions of shares, which makes it all more affordable for everyone. Everyone's now getting a chance to get into this field and really understand the importance of profit in companies, the importance of growth in companies. The importance of, you know, the value they can see over the long haul building an investment portfolio of their own based on their own investment decisions, as opposed to having all those decisions made for them through the pension or whatever other mutual funds they were a part of in the past.
I wish that one of my great regrets, and I'm sure you hear this all the time, I'm 37 now. I wish that I realized the power of compounding when I was 20. You know, a few less nights out at the bar or whatever, and put that in just an index fund. And I mean, I could have been a millionaire by the time I was 50 if you do it right. You don't even have to make a ton of money. I wish that I would have learned that at a younger age.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, even, yeah, a modest amount of money invested in interest-bearing securities, and that compounding pay off for you, much less investing in the stock market where you ought to be when you're younger. You know, you ought to be putting most of your portfolio into equities, because over the long haul, equities are going to produce an 8 to 10% growth per year on average. And when you compound that growth, it adds up in a big way.
So a lot of us are doing the passive stuff right now, the passive index funds, just put it in an S&P 500, put it in emerging markets and just sit it and forget it. Does that make a guy's job on Wall Street more difficult now compared to when you were there? I know that's not really what you were doing, but does it make it more difficult or easier? How would you say that?
It's making it more difficult for the active managers. You know, it's getting, I think what people are seeing is that the active managers on average were having trouble beating the indexes anyway. So if you take that S&P 500 and look at how the whole S&P 500 has performed on an index basis over time, it's hard for active managers to beat that over the long haul. But active managers, you're paying them 2-4% to manage that money, whereas in a passive fund, it's pennies because they're simply automatically using artificial intelligence, frankly, at this point, to just automatically track exactly what the market is. So they track exactly that S&P average. And that's what's going to deliver you that 8 to 10% growth per year over the long haul.
So you're a passive guy then? You know, I mean,
you know, I don't have as much time as I'd like to put into actively managing my portfolio. So yeah. I've tended to be more of a passive investor over time in my personal money, as opposed to being a very active investor in what my work life was.
Yeah, that's fascinating. All right. I want to talk to you about cryptocurrencies. This is a very controversial topic. I feel like it's... I'll kick myself forever, but when I got that bug that I was telling, at one point I owned 3 Bitcoins. I went back and looked, and because I bought them when they were like $400 or whatever. And I ended up selling them at like $1,700. And I was like, yeah, this is great. Look at this profit. And now I look at it now and it's like, you know, if I would have held on, if I had 3 Bitcoins now, I mean, you're talking almost $200,000 to whatever it's going to be. What are your thoughts on this? Are you pro, anti? Are you still learning? Specifically, we'll just go with Bitcoin, because there's a million cryptocurrencies. Like, not all are created equal. How do you view these?
I would characterize myself as a skeptic.
Okay.
You know, it's all faith-based. I mean, there's no underlying value underlying Bitcoin. So it's really just a matter of whether people are willing to buy them and believe that over time they're going to grow in value. There's nothing to measure. There's nothing to look at to say why they would be increasing in value.
Yeah.
You know, you're not tying it to the earnings of a company. You're not tying it to the increase in value from a piece of real estate that you've bought. You're not tying it to growth in the cash flow being generated by a farm property you own. This is purely based on, are enough people going to believe in this over time to drive an increase in value in it? And I just find that I find that hard to jump into. You know, some people would argue the U.S. dollar is the same, right? U.S. dollar is totally based on faith. There isn't anything underlying the dollar anymore. We went off the gold standard 50 years ago. And so that dollar is just based on people's trust in that the dollar is going to be worth a dollar tomorrow. But there's a lot behind that. There's the U.S. government behind that. There are many foreign nations who have to hold dollars for a variety of reasons because the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency of the world. There is no reason anybody has to hold Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. There's nothing driving underlying value there. And that's what would concern me about tying up a lot of money. Now, that can be, you know, if you look at a diversified portfolio, you want to have something like that as part of your portfolio. You know, I'd put that in the highly speculative end of your portfolio that ought to be kept at a kind of a managed level, a 5% kind of level of what you have overall.
Yeah. That's always your biggest worry with the crypto stuff. I mean, because China recently like banned it. They completely,
right.
You know, I mean, what if there's a headline on CNBC tomorrow that the United States is going to do that? It could go from 60,000 to 5,000 pretty quickly. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. And you know, and you also, you look at these hacks that happen with these cryptocurrencies right now.
Yeah.
Bitcoin is tied into the blockchain. Blockchain, mm-hmm. I don't think, is something that can be easily hacked. But if you look at some of these other cryptocurrencies, you know, somebody comes along, swoops in, and seems to be able to grab large parts of what's available and steal it. And that would be a concern as well. It's hard to feel secure in what you have invested in that area.
Okay. I think the last year and a half has been as crazy of a time for investing in businesses, probably of my lifetime, I would say. I mean, maybe you would have to go back to, I don't know, you were there 2008, that was pretty crazy, I guess. But it seemed like, okay, so the government's giving out all this money because of the COVID relief funds and stuff. And then you have all these people who have Robinhood, and they get on Reddit and they're like, oh, we're going to make this company, right? Like, we're going to, what was the one, the GameStop. Yeah. It was just crazy, right? Is it, I think it's good that we can make trades on our phones for free, but I also think that there's probably like you just said on the crypto thing, because I've dabbled in it. I am not 100% in it, but I'm probably more of a believer than you are, but I'm not, but I know people who like will have 70-80% of their portfolio in these cryptocurrencies. So has the pandemic, while it's gotten more people involved in investing, which is a good thing, has it also been a little negative in the sense that, you know, once we had these stimulus packages, it seemed like the stock market just shot up. Well, it's not always just going to go up, right? Like that, I do have slight concern for people who don't necessarily know what they're doing, losing a lot.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we've seen this happen before when day trading has come in. There were a lot of individuals who came into the stock market in the late 90s during the dot-com boom when the internet was first getting going. They made a lot of money until they didn't.
Yeah.
And then 2007, 2008, individuals came roaring in again. People were day trading. As the democratization of the markets began, they did really well, but then everything came crashing down. And so it's you know, you have to understand that these markets are cyclical. They do go down just like they go up. And I think, frankly, the GameStop people, the people who've invested in that, have had a chance to see that one ride like a roller coaster, right? So you got to have a strong stomach to be a part of something like that and continue to be a part of something like that. And again, I would encourage people who do that, make that a part of your portfolio. Don't make that the core of your portfolio, but make that speculative bets in a smaller part of what you do.
How do we, here at the Ivy College of Business, do you guys, do you talk about cryptos and stuff like that? Is that part of the curriculum or is that being worked in?
Yeah, I mean, it is the kind of thing that comes up in our finance classes.
Yeah.
And we have faculty who do research in that area. So,
interesting.
So it is something that, you know, you've always got to be looking at what the next thing is.
I want to come back to college.
Oh, we'd love to have you. let's talk about our master's degrees.
Okay, there you go.
For you.
Well,
okay,
you know what it reminds me of, though? I was talking with a friend of Tim Day. He's a good friend of mine. And we were discussing when I was in journalism, again, I graduated 03 to 07. Nobody knew what was the future. Mm-hmm. Twitter didn't exist.
Right.
We didn't know if what were newspapers going to do. I didn't really ever want to write for a newspaper because I didn't, I was on the web. You know, I was like, let's do a website. But the professors and a lot of the students, we didn't know where anything was going. And we couldn't really teach Twitter. Facebook had just become a thing, like when I was a sophomore. And it really is quite difficult when we're talking about technology and it's ever changing So that's great. I want to come and take a cryptocurrency class. Maybe someday I could teach it. No?
Outstanding. You know, one of the keys to this, though, I mean, because it hasn't changed today. Nobody really knows the future any better in 2021 than they knew in 2007.
Yeah.
The key thing with our students is to engender in our students the sense of being lifelong learners.
No doubt.
That learning does not end at age 22 or 23 when you walk out of here with your diploma. You've got to continue learning in life.
No doubt.
Because life and business is going to constantly change. And I do think one of the benefits for our students who went through this very tough time over the last 18 months or so with COVID is they learned a lot about needing to be resilient. They learned a lot about having to pivot. They learned a lot about having to deal with unexpected change. And that's a lot of what business is about.
Yeah, I think a lot of, if you didn't do that in business, we had to do it in our business. I always like to evolve or die. I mean, my little notebook right here, it says evolve on it, right? And we would have died last year, but we had to make significant changes and we had to see it. And you have to know your business well enough to know, okay, ad revenue is about to completely drop because nobody's spending any money right now. We've got to figure out another way to be able to pay our bills.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, that's what makes like restaurants and having to use Uber Eats and, you know, Grubhub and be able to evolve like that. It's been really fascinating. Do you buy into the fact, I kind of think that we accelerated technologically about 5 years and over the course of a year? Do you buy into that?
I think we did, but the question is, did the pendulum swing too much, right?
Yeah.
So we did what we had to do to adapt and use technology to an extreme. How much is that going to get dialed back as this becomes an endemic? COVID sort of goes away as the pandemic challenge that it is becomes just part of life, just like the flu is a part of life. So how much of that is going to kind of swing back? And really, I think what you'll end up doing is you'll end up using a lot of that technology is going to enhance what had been the historic way of working and operating in this country. I think people are social beings. I think they want to be back together by and large. I think there are real advantages from a collaboration standpoint in having people back together in the offices, back together in classrooms. But that swing that we made with technology is going to allow us to find ways to enhance that. So are you going to travel as much as you used to? Well, I think we've found that there are things that we can get done because you can make a different connection, frankly, doing things by Zoom and video calls that you could if you were doing this all by the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
Having to do what we did, shut down the economy and do all that just by telephone, I think that would have been incredibly destructive.
Yeah.
This definitely worked better, but I think it's going to end up being more integrated into the way we've operated at least for the last 20 years or so in the economy.
Okay, a couple more Wall Street questions, and then we'll get to some other stuff, because I want to talk to you about the College of Business and the name, image, and likeness and all that stuff with athletics. Okay, so when I flip on CNBC, are those guys all full of crap? Like, I mean, can I take anything from that, or should I just turn it off? I feel like half of them are full of crap.
Yeah, you got to be running a big filter with that, right?
Everybody
who's on there's got something to sell, and oftentimes there's no substance. The stuff they're selling doesn't have any substance behind it.
Okay, so when a guy or gal gives like their stock pick of the day, are they bought or are the? Because in journalism, like you can't. If I'm covering somebody, I can't let that person buy me a coffee, right? Because, like, if this guy's like, I want the Disney stock, that's my big buy, I would guess that there's some people who are watching who are going to go and do that just because that guy said it, right? So they're effectively changing the price. Like, are those guys for real?
I'm sure depending on which stock they're pushing, some may be pumping something they own that they want to sell.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
But you know,
I didn't think about it like that.
Yeah. So it's the pump and dump. So you put that out, a lot of demand comes in, you sell your shares into that news that you've just put out in the marketplace about the value of the stock. So I'm sure there's some of that goes on, but you know, a lot of those guys are trying to attract money. They're trying to attract a following. So they really don't want to sell you a dud. The Wolves of Wall Street approach, which is the pump and dump, call somebody up, hey, all my clients are going into the stock. Well, usually that means that all their clients may be going in, but their firm is trying to get out of that stock, right? They're trying to dump that stock. I think CNBC is, the people who are appearing there are a little bit more sophisticated than that. So I think the guy there who's pumping Disney is pumping Disney because really what he wants is he wants you to think of investing with his firm. So he doesn't want to sell you a total dud there.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure all of them, you know, have that same level of credibility.
Did you ever watch the show Billions?
I do. I enjoy that. That's a great show.
Yeah, it's my favorite.
That's a great show.
I haven't started season 5 yet. I got to get around to it, but football season makes it kind of tough.
Right.
Yeah. That's I got into that over the pandemic. How realistic is a show like that?
I think that's pretty realistic for the way those hedge funds operate. You know, those hedge funds, they're swinging for the fences every single day. And there are a lot of them who operate just like that. But you remember he's already made his billions, right? So he's got a lot of money available to play with.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like my own personal portfolio.
No, he's got a pile of his money in U.S. Treasuries as well. So he's got his get rich money and he's got his stay rich money, and his stay rich money is invested in Treasuries, and his get rich money is being used in all these aggressive bets that he's making.
That's what I always say though. If you won like $1 million, let's say you won why wouldn't you just put it in, like you're talking about with the and then you could just get paid interest the rest of your life. And I mean, right? Is it that simple? Because it seems like it.
Well, it could be. Now, you're not going to get as rich as if you put that in a diversified portfolio.
I mean, how much money do I need, though? You know.
Well, yeah, fair point. Fair point.
No, I get it. So, like, but what about dividends, though? Because I always thought that, too. It's like, okay, if I had $1 million and I just put it in, like, a Vanguard high dividend fund, like, isn't that just going to pay me, like, a paycheck every month?
It's going to pay a paycheck every month, and the underlying stocks can appreciate in value more than bonds are going to do. So bonds, you don't really see bonds appreciate in value. So you put that money in fixed income, you put that money in bonds, you're going to get that interest payment every quarter or every month. But you're not going to see an underlying appreciation in what you've invested in. Whereas if you invest in a high dividend stock fund, you're going to both collect those dividends and see that stock move up over time.
That's good stuff. All right. Let's get back to the academia aspect of all this. So I will say this, I've been guilty of this, and it's not right. And I've actually done a lot of research on what you guys have done here. And I feel like you're very different, but in my mind, I was journalism at a really weird time. So I got out of there and like, I wasn't going to work for a newspaper because one, they were all getting laid off and like, you know, mixing the real world with the academia aspect of it, that seems like it's a pretty core value of what you all are doing. How do you do that? Because I think that there is a perception out there for somebody who didn't get a college degree but has been successful, and they're like, oh, well, I don't need that. Look at me. The real world is all I need. But there's got to be a happy medium to that.
You know, when people ask me what's the one number I look at to measure our success here in the Ivy College of Business, it's our placement rate. So we've got to be placing our graduates at a high percentage, and we have to be placing them in good paying jobs. So that's really what it comes down to here. And if we want to accomplish those objectives, one of the really good ways to do that is to make sure that the education we're providing them here is practical and real, that it's tied to what's going on in business today, that's preparing them to be successful in business today. And so we do that by having faculty, first of all, who are leading researchers in their field. And so our faculty are doing work at the cutting edge of their field every single day. They're reading what's going on in that field. They're studying what businesses are doing. They're writing papers that are going to be read by business faculty around the world about the way things are changing in business. And they bring all of that work back into the classroom. So that's one important way we make sure we're providing a very real and up-to-date education for our students. Second thing is we stay very closely tied with industry. So each one of our departments has an advisory council made up of people who are involved in hiring our students or people who are involved in supervising our students early in their career. So they're constantly giving us feedback. You know, you need to give them more Excel. You need to be talking more about cryptocurrencies. Mm. You need to be talking more about blockchain. And we then revise our curriculum and make sure our curriculum is staying up to date with what those folks are advising us to do. And then a third thing is we're bringing speakers from industry into the classroom. Mm. So we're giving the students a chance to say, you know, here I am in Marketing 340. Oh my God, I can't get through Marketing 340. Why am I studying this? This is driving me crazy. Well, you bring in that person who's got a successful career in marketing, who talks about what's life going to be like on the other side. You know, here's why you're learning these principles in Marketing 340, because it's going to pay off for you when you get out in that career in the real world.
Yeah, that's awesome. I admire it. I again, I I do regret. I wish I would have gotten a business degree from here, looking back on it. So one of the things that I think is fascinating, I talk about this honestly, more than I would like to over the summer. It was a daily topic on my radio show, was the name, image, and likeness thing. And my biggest thing, I'm totally fine with it. I think it's great. I was afraid, though, working in the industry that I do, there are a lot of shysters out there, right? There just are. It's a very cutthroat world in media. And I was very concerned more for the well-being of, I don't want them to get fleeced, you know? That was my biggest thing. I want them to be able to make what they're worth and what they can get. It was comforting to see you guys are involved with this. So how did that all work out when, you know, when that law passed or whatever, I don't think it's a law, but when that rule passes, did Jamie Pollard come to you guys? Did you guys raise your hand and say, let us be a part of this? How does that all work together?
You know, it was a little bit of both. You know, we were reading a little bit about what was going on around that, and I'd reached out to Jamie. At the same time, his folks were reaching out to us to see if we could find a way to work together. And it's interesting when you start out with the idea of how people could be taken advantage of. The very first workshop that we did a couple of weeks ago for a group of student athletes was around the business, the law, legal aspects of this, the contractual aspects of this, the tax aspects of this. Yeah. And so, you know, let's not start with how you sell yourself. Let's start with how you protect yourself. And we've got a great faculty member here, Mike Bootsma, who's an award-winning teacher here on campus, who did a great session for the student athletes on the kinds of things you need to be careful of when you're signing a contract, the kinds of things you have to be careful of when you're reaching any sort of agreement with someone to participate with them in a deal like this. And then, remember, the government's going to want to be paid taxes on all this. So no matter how they're delivering it to you, remember, taxes are going to have to be paid.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was kind of a deal where a lot of people were stuck on that. And then you get to the whole amateurism versus employee thing and the tax scholarships and all that. How do you, you're a sports fan, right?
I am.
Okay. Do you have an opinion on all the controversies going on with student athletes right now? Cause it seems like, I don't know, it seems like there's five or six different things just kind of floating around and nobody really knows where to land.
Yeah, you know, some of this, though, I think is about making things better for the student.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, things had kind of gotten out of whack. The amount of money that was coming into college athletics, it had to go someplace. It was going to facilities. It was going to coaches' salaries. It was going to administrators' salaries. It really wasn't going to give as much benefit to the students as they should get out of the hard work they're putting in. The scholarship's definitely a great payback for them, and the education is a great payback for them. But when you look at the total pot of money that's coming in, they were getting a pretty small share of things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do worry about this being the wild, wild west. To your point, there are people out there who are going to try to, you know, try to screw the student athlete.
Yeah, no doubt.
In these deals, and there are too many student athletes for this all to be, you know, overseen by some governing authority. And so people are going to be left somewhat out there on their own. They're going to have to be thoughtful about what they do. And I think that's why we can play a role in helping to educate the student athletes and have them better prepared to deal with what's going to be coming at them with this.
So there's more coming. This isn't like, oh, we're just going to do a workshop here. Like how do you see this evolving potentially?
Yeah. So we're starting this with a couple of workshops here during the fall semester, but we're going to switch to a custom education approach starting in the spring. We're going to have a series of short courses that we'll offer for the athletes. I think, you know, to your point, all the athletes could benefit by coming to the Ivy College of Business and majoring here in marketing or in entrepreneurship, which would be good fields to help them with that name, image, likeness. But we know they're not all going to want to do that.
Yeah. And that's a thing, too. Not all of them are, I mean, many of them will probably make a little bit of money, but they won't exceed the $600 to even need a 1099. That's the perception. It's just so funny to me. Again, I do this every day on sports talk radio, so it's a different world than the office that you sit in, but we all overreacted. Right. And I knew at the time we were overreacting, but it was so new.
Right.
Like, we had all covered NCAA football or whatever for 17 years for me, and then all of a sudden, a light switched and the rules were just gone.
Right.
You know, it was such a... It seemed like such a huge seminal moment in that. And it, I mean, there's probably, I don't know, maybe 100 who have made real good money nationwide. When I say that, you know, I'm talking in the maybe 50,000 or more, but most of them are still not. And then, I don't know, it gets really, I still don't really quite know what to think about it. Cause my big thing is I don't want to, I've traveled with like the women's basketball team, right? Those are real student athletes.
Right.
They are, we're landing in West Virginia and they're going to study table for 2 hours. That's how it works. And I don't want to limit opportunities for student athletes like that down the road. That's what I want to look out for.
Well, I think, you know, part of the question here is how much of a role social media is going to play in all of this. And so there was an early article that one of the real winners of this might be a young lady who's a gymnast at the University of Nebraska, because the University of Nebraska gymnastics team has such a broad following. You know, she's got 100,000 followers on social media, and monetizing that following is a way they can deliver money to somebody who you wouldn't expect to be one of the winners in all this, right? You thought it was all going to be about
the quarterback.
All right, it was going to be about Spencer Rattler and Brock Purdy making a lot of money, but instead, here's a way where the gymnast, in a state where they don't have as many entertainment alternatives over in Nebraska, and so that gymnastics team has a big following, you know, all of a sudden she's got an opportunity to make some money to supplement her college experience.
How do they fit together? So I'm talking academics and athletics, because there's also the side of it, and I don't really believe this, because again, I've seen it firsthand, but there are others who believe, well, they are, the football player is an employee and of the athletic department, basically. But I'm assuming over the course of your career, you've seen firsthand how these two things mutually benefit one another.
Absolutely. We've had great athletes in the classroom here in the Ivy College of Business. We had a piece we did a couple of years ago in our magazine, then called Prospectus Magazine, now called Ivy Magazine. And it hit on George Niang's involvement with
That was good.
John Wong, one of our faculty members, and George in that class. And I'd hear from people about George always sitting up in the front of the room in the class, always being one of the first ones when there was a guest speaker in, always the first one to raise his hand with a question for that guest speaker. Athletes have gotten an awful lot out of their education, and they need to think about that. You know, those ads the NCAA does are true, right? Yeah, so few of them are actually going to go on to a pro career. They need to make sure they're taking advantage of the educational opportunities here, and I think Iowa State does a great job with that.
So do you think we found the name, image, and likeness thing? Is this a sweet spot, or do you think that – do you see this going a little bit further, probably?
I bet it's going to go further.
I think it almost has to, I would think.
Right. Right. And we're in very early days of this. Everybody's trying to figure this out. It was interesting. University of Texas just did something where they put together a list of all their student athletes, and they put that out to a group of corporate supporters of the University of Texas saying, you know, here's a listing of our student athletes. Here's how to reach each one of them. Here's how to get them involved with you and your products. And you can sort of act like a clearinghouse like that, it appears. But I'm not sure everybody's even completely clear on the regulations at this point, and entirely how you ought to play some of this stuff.
I think everybody's kind of just figuring it out,
right?
From what I've seen. Like, I don't even think it's conference by conference. I think they're trying, but I feel like it's more school by school and program by program, and we're all just in a feeling out process, but it's fascinating. Well, sir, I know you're a busy man. You spent enough time with a hack like me today. You're raising my IQ a little bit. This is good. I'm usually hanging out with the blogger crowd, so this is great.
All right, but you got to tell me what's going to happen in the other Manhattan on Saturday.
Oh, clones. I like the clones. They've been such a thorn in our side, you know?
We've not had good luck over
there, October.
Right?
We don't lose in October. When's the last time Iowa State's lost a game in October? What about you? What's your pick?
I'm right there. Brocktober is here, right?
Yes.
And Kansas State hasn't faced a defense like ours yet, and I think that's really going to make a difference.
Yeah, I think that you're right. I hope so, because if we win on Saturday, then it kind of opens everything else up for the rest of the season. Well, thank you very much for your time. We'll have to do this maybe next year, and we'll see where everything is gone.
I'd enjoy it. I'm going to mark down what Bitcoin's selling for today, so I'm ready for that a year from now.
We're going to be at 100,000. 100,000 a year from now. No, that's a whole other podcast. I could pick your brain for an hour on blockchain and all that stuff, so we won't bore the audience. But thank you, sir. appreciate your time and keep doing the good work.
A pleasure. Thanks so much, Chris.
All right. Thank you.